Well, good afternoon and welcome. My name is Barry Rabe. I'm a professor here at the Ford School and direct CLOSUP, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, which is very pleased to be sponsoring today's event. As some of you may know, about this time a year ago, we had an event that really celebrated the publication of a book by Margie Dewar and June Manning Thomas called The City After Abandonment, and had a full and robust discussion of that book, which raised a great many issues for the future of urban political economy with significant relevance to Metro Detroit, but many other areas. And it was really wonderful working with Margie and June on all aspects of that, and it remains a wonderful book. One of many topics surfaced that day, but one was discussing other cases that might be particularly relevant to some of the larger issues of this idea of what happens to a city after substantial population decline. And Youngstown, Ohio, as I recall, came up not only in the book but in the conversation that day. And so in follow-up conversations with Margie and June, we thought it would really be terrific to come back a year later and focus specifically on this case of Youngstown, Ohio. And so we're very pleased to be able to present lessons from Youngstown planning for a smaller, greener city. I'm going to turn things over to Margie at this point, who will be introducing our visitors and discussing the plan for the day. So welcome to all of you, and Margie, it's all yours.
So Youngstown 2010, this is the cover of the plan shown here, was a plan completed in Youngstown in 2005. Youngstown's a city, for those of you not from this region, that's at the far east edge of Ohio between Pittsburgh and Cleveland. And it traditionally was a steel-producing area until the late 1970s and early 1980s when the mills, and all of the mills closed. Since its peak in the 1930s, Youngstown had lost 61% of its population by 2010, and it had lost 45% of its peak number of households. Its population in 2010 was 67,000. And so that means that the city had a massive adjustment to go through, which meant considerable surplus of housing, surplus of commercial and industrial structures, a lot of disinvestment. So around the beginning, the early 2000s, people realized Youngstown's plan is, maybe they realized this before but hadn't taken action, Youngstown's plan was decades out of date. And the city needed a new one to guide public decisions, the decisions of investors, the decisions of institutions, the decisions of residents. They needed a framework. And they needed an idea of where they wanted to go. What are we trying to be? And what came out of this process of the Youngstown 2010 planning was an excellent plan, two major features of which were, first of all, an enormous amount of involvement by people in the city and by the institutions represented there. The plan won a national award from the American Planning Association for its community involvement. And second, it was notable for accepting that Youngstown was a smaller city than it had been and was going to be smaller, that it wasn't going to grow back to its former size. And it could actually be a better, smaller city. So then how to make this smaller city a better place for people to live? This might not seem so novel to many of you in this, but it really is. Planners tend to focus on growth and development. And most plans deal with planning for growth and development. And so this was a fairly novel approach that therefore got considerable attention. Since then, other cities have followed in Youngstown's path. Flint has a new plan that is much more accepting of being smaller. Detroit Future City, that came out a little more than a year ago, is much more oriented towards saying Detroit's going to be smaller, even smaller than it is right now, but what we aim for is more stability and quality of life. And Cleveland, to some extent, has looked in this direction as well. So now what many of us wonder, since Youngstown got going on this earlier than anyone else, and now it's the plan was completed in 2005, so it's almost 10 years since it's been in place. So what are the results? So when you make a plan like this, what happens? How does it change a city? Does it achieve its goals? This holds lessons, I think, for Detroit, Flint, and the others who are trying to think in this way as well. So therefore, we invited experts on Youngstown. Ian Beniston is Deputy Director of the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation. Hunter Morrison was, at the time of the Youngstown 2010 planning process, the Director of the Urban and Regional Studies Center, and also a chief planner for Youngstown State University, was heavily involved in Youngstown 2010. And John Russo, a visiting research fellow at Virginia Tech's Metropolitan Institute, a longtime faculty member at Youngstown State University, and the author of Steeltown. So June Thomas and I are going to ask them some leading questions and want to hear, well, what became of this plan after its completion. So first question is really to Hunter. So how did this planning process change what Youngstown State did? This was supposed to affect institutions' decision-making. Did it? What happened?
Well, perhaps we should show some of the slides, but Youngstown State is an urban university, which started out in Youngstown as a YMCA college, and for many years was grounded and very much in place in the community. In the late 1960s, the state of Ohio, in the effort to expand the number of universities, bought Youngstown State, the predecessor of Cleveland State, and the predecessor of the University of Akron, but created those as state universities. So Youngstown has always been in the center of town and has always been co-identified with the city and has been historically viewed as the place where people get the skills to either transition within the economy, back in the steel era, or to get the education to leave the region, which is what happened to many people after the steel industry collapsed. It physically is proximate to the downtown, but it's isolated by about a 40 or 50 foot grade change between the downtown and the campus. Think Cornell, but not nearly as dramatic. And also, more importantly, by an attitude. It was very much the city on the hill. A lot of rhetoric over the years about being part of the community, and certainly part of the social life of the community, but physically distinct. And unlike Ann Arbor and the university here, the seamless connection between the campus and the community actually never was in place. Youngstown State University was one of the co-conveners of the 2010 plan through the Center for Urban and Regional Studies, because a new president came aboard, David Sweet, and agreed with the mayor to co-convene a process. From our perspective, it meant that we put on hold our update of our master plan until the city had its broader planning plan in place. We dedicated our resources at the center to co-editing the document and co-developing it. And our GIS capacity was basically what the university or what the city used. But in terms of how it influenced us, it gave us the impetus, but also the rationale, but also the physical ways and means and ways to think about how the university and the campus could work together. There are about 13,000 to 14,000 students, most of them commuter students on Youngstown State University campus. From a marketing perspective, that's about 20,000, 28,000 credit cards. That's a lot of mouths to feed. Pretty much it was a school you went to class, went home, went back to where you lived. Not a lot of people live on the campus. And what we saw was the physical isolation reinforced this sort of sense of two separate places. So we used it in many ways to understand how to develop the edges around the campus, particularly as it related to locating a business school, but how also to collaborate with the city on some capital investments that benefited both. What we found is by suggesting that a 5-minute walking radius, about a quarter mile and a half mile of 10-minute walking radius was an area of shared interest, then we got the city actually, when I expected there was going to be a lot of pushback, the city said, thank God you're finally figuring this out, and was given their limited resources, very collaborative in how to develop that zone that we have a shared interest in. But it gave us a mechanism to do it, and following all the public engagement process, a clear mandate that people wanted to see the university and the camp and the downtown come together. And it gave us, I think, a way of having those discussions in a manner that allowed us to invest substantial funds in an area that, in fact, we were able to co-catalyze.
Did you want to explain?
Yeah. This is the campus plan. Youngstown, the diagonal is the river. Mahoning River, along which lie the steel mills. The campus itself is right at the northern end of a what was called a kind of a lozenge. This is a freeway interbelt that was put into the 60s. The campus is here. The downtown is there. It looks very close, but again, there's that grade change. What we developed as part of the 2010 effort was an understanding of this interest of share this area of shared interest, the core campus. About 5 minutes walk, about a quarter mile is down to the core of the historic downtown retail district. About 10 minutes walk is almost to the Mahoning River. And our effort was to really look with the city at this area immediately around us. Frankly, it's the area that parents will drive around when they're dropping their kids off. And within it, you've got several other anchor institutions, a well-regarded retirement community, the St. Elizabeth Medical Center, which is one of the two hospitals, a community health center, and the downtown. We then used that again to frame up what we would know in planning as a structure plan, where we saw how the core campus and the investments we were making could be tied back to a downtown and break the 60 or the 40-foot grade change. And for the first time, most of the other predecessor plans by the university basically said, here's our campus, and then conveniently airbrushed out everything else. Like, we sort of exist in a vacuum, quite literally. It's sort of like those old maps about terra incognita and their dinosaurs and their sea serpents beyond the pale. Well, our campus was a very tight campus, and we basically said, we need to break through that. This is a zone of a pretty significant disinvestment. We saw that as a key anchor linkage between the core campus, this is the new business school, and down to the bottom. And then later, about three or four years ago, we worked with the state of Ohio. This is our STEM college, our business school, and the Youngstown Business Incubator, which now houses the America Makes Additive Manufacturing Center, and saw this very tight zone of about quarter acre as a place, or quarter mile by quarter mile, as a place where we could collaborate with the city and the business community and the state to create a spine of development. As a result of that, to strategy, we're seeing investment in renovation of Burnham, Daniel Burnham quality, Daniel Burnham design office buildings into housing, restaurants, and the like. So this has become quite a vital area, which 10 years ago was pretty much empty.
So in urban planning, there's a lot of interest in anchor institutions like Youngstown State and what effect they can have on strengthening adjacent areas, which is what Hunter was just talking about. But What about the rest of the city, the neighborhoods especially, in your work centers on that? What has Youngstown 2010 accomplished for neighborhoods?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If we could go quickly maybe back to the map clicker here. So if you look at this map, you'll see Hunter specifically talked about the center of town here, but the city is 33.5 square miles, as Margie mentioned. There's about 23,000 vacant lots. There's infrastructure in the city for about 250,000 people. As was mentioned in the introduction, we have about 65,000. So we have a lot of space, we have a lot of vacancy, just a lot of challenges. Many of you have probably been to Detroit, you know, similar situation in Youngstown in many areas. So if you look at this map, there's vast swaths of vacancy, the south side, east side. And as far as 2010, I think the big questions were, what are we going to do about it? And as was mentioned, the process was very much momentous and built a lot of energy in the community. And when the plan was adopted, I think, and I know where Margie wants me to go here, but one of the challenges was that there was not a significant amount of capacity in the city to take the plan and move it forward, particularly outside of your anchor district. So in the center city, where you have a lot of anchors, assets to build from, the rest of the city is not flush with those type of assets or things that you can easily look to and build from. So we needed more of an infrastructure and a real strategy neighborhood by neighborhood, which has taken quite a bit of time to get there. We do have the infrastructure now, and we are actually going through another citywide planning process at this moment that's a little more, I think, action-oriented and grounded in reality. We do have quite a bit of capacity now that didn't exist when the plan was adopted, but I think one of the key things to note today is that while the plan, people say, what's happened in the neighborhoods, and a lot of people say, well, many houses have been demolished, but not much beyond that. One of the things that you don't see that I am really convinced occurred as a result of 2010 is that capacity was created. And what I mean by that is the organization I work for, the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation, which is now really the city's citywide planning and development organization. There's been a significant group called the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative that's also assisted with neighborhood capacity. We have a county land bank. None of these things even existed when the plan was adopted. So, I mean, my job didn't exist. So things have advanced, and we've been able to make real tangible progress in the neighborhoods. It's certainly not enough given the context and the severity of the issues, but we do have an infrastructure in place now.
So, John, you're not associated with either of the institutions that they're describing at this point. So we're wondering, as a more dispassionate observer, what do you see as some of the successes of the plan?
Well, I'm a part of and apart from. I serve on the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative's board, which was the foundation for the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation, and a lot of work that was done in the 2008 and 2009 that Ian was involved in. They organized 44 neighborhood groups in the Youngstown-Warren area and built the capacity. And I think they strengthened the whole neighborhood's ability to want to ask for change. And I think that Ian has continued that. But I'm not as optimistic about the overall what happened in the plan as I think Hunter and Ian. You got to remember, this is a very inbred panel. We're all sort of friends. We've all served in these sort of capacities. We have different sort of attitudes toward this. And one person who's not here is James Rhodes, who I'm writing this new book with. But since he's a junior faculty member, I always like to mention his name because he's part of this. I think you have to start out with and understand a term that my wife uses, that deindustrialization has a half-life. And what I mean by that, deindustrialized areas like Flint and Youngstown, East Chicago, simply don't get over the havoc created both collectively and individually because of corporate disinvestment and deindustrialization. there's a type of collateral damage that happens to a community. It's just not economic. There's a not only is there sort of physical, the health problems, suicides, but there's a sense of community agency. There's a sense of loss, a feeling of failure, a loss of pride and a sense of shame. And all of these things are occurring in the community. And I think one thing that the 2010 plan did is it tried to come to grips with that. And it, to the point that they created a plan that had both economic development issues associated with it. It also had a message of growth after years of being the poster child for deindustrialization in America. And the part of the plan that was seemingly successful was the economic development parts of it, at least in theory. An example is that the Youngstown Business Incubator gets enormous amounts of press. It now has the advanced manufacturing associated with it. When we were doing research, we found how many people at work at that place actually live in Youngstown? Two. Okay? They don't live in Youngstown. And the point of it is all the types of issues related to the neighborhoods was completely lost. This plan was about economic development. It was the idea of that we could somehow burnish our image as a former steel town, ultimately to attract new business by suggesting that we were new and improved, and that we could compete effectively in the global economy and with our sister cities around the Rust Belt. In essence, it put us in competition for new forms of economic development. In the process, it gave up a lot of governance issues to public-private partnerships. It forgot about the neighborhood parts of the plan. It ultimately transformed parts of the downtown, especially for millennials who were born and lived in the area who had never experienced what the city had been like. To them, parts of the downtown seemed like the best that the city has ever been. Of course, there was a patina around this, okay? That how it was sold. And the language and the narratives about that were like corporate restructuring. Okay? This wasn't an end, it's a new beginning. Right-sizing, rebranding. These are all types of narratives and language that follow right out of neoliberal corporate restructuring themes, which I know has been a part of the discussion here a couple of months ago.
John, before you go on, I'm just wondering if you could... So one thing you mentioned was that it gave much of government to public-private, but forgot about the neighborhoods. Could you kind of give some examples,
specific examples
of that?
The issues related to demolitions, the issues related to code enforcement, the issues related to crime, the issues related to city government being halfway available to the neighborhoods just simply wasn't there. I always say to Ian and Hunter, how could you have this great plan and not have a city planner? Okay? Think about that. So, and does that suggest that the plan really wasn't about the neighborhoods? It was only about economic development.
I think you'd have to explain to this audience your statement that it didn't have a city planner because they may not understand.
Well, when the as Hunter said, you're right. But the point of it is that during the sort of planning process and the development of the city plan, of the 2010, there was a city planner. But not long afterwards, he resigned and quit. And the chief advocate at that time, the mayor, chose not to replace him. Okay? So if you're really interested in 2010 and a real plan, and you really are concerned about the neighborhood and all the public discussions that occurred in the lead-up, you've got to ask yourself, why? Was this just a fig leaf?
So
And that's one of the things. But this, what's important here, because I don't want to sort of end with the idea that it was only economic development. What Hunter and the 2010 people did, and that is that, and Ian has suggested it, when the government and the private interest didn't do anything, it was the community groups had a framework to begin dealing with some of the issues that are in the 2010 plan. But it wasn't city government, it wasn't the economic business people, it was the neighborhood people who did that. The most important piece of work is the piece that Ian did when he literally walked the city and found where all the vacant properties and foreclosures were occurring and put that out. And everybody, the city government said, geez, we're surprised. We didn't think it was this bad. It was pathetic. And I think that was one of the reasons why the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative said, look, this neighborhood issue is really important. We have to spin off to this group, to the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation.
So let's ask Ian, what do you agree with that the neighborhoods essentially saw nothing? You mentioned that capacity was greatly increased.
Yeah,
What does it mean for the residents? What does it mean for the neighborhoods? Experiences.
Sure. I mean, I agree with many of the things John says, but I disagree a little bit in that the neighborhoods were forgotten about. I think you saw a lot of leaning towards economic development because that's where people existed that knew how to do things. Again, there wasn't capacity, which when I say that, I mean there weren't people in City Hall that knew how to do anything. There weren't people that knew how to do anything about anything. And what 2010 created was this energy in the community that not only in City Hall, but through all partners in the community business, you saw local foundations stepping up. The Ween Foundation in particular, who was the largest foundation, totally reoriented their giving from, you know, maybe giving to a scholarship fund here at UM or Yale to fully putting their money back into the community, starting organizations like ours. And the city eventually did come around. I mean, it took a couple years, but in 2008, 2009, the organization I work for, the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation, began through the president of the local foundation and the mayor coming together, basically saying, I think we know now, and we all agree, we don't have capacity to do what we need to do. There aren't people in City Hall that can carry out many of the things that need to be done. So the city put some money forward, as well as the foundation, to start our organization, which I didn't really tell you much about, but we are a citywide community development and planning organization, so we do function now as the city's planning department. There's a formal agreement and contract. We also carry out housing work, vacant land reuse, some neighborhood economic development. We operate a loan fund. We've been able to put together a wealth of resources, so not just city funds, but leverage and broker, corporate, public, private, foundation funds, and assemble a team. So if John mentioned there is no planner, well, I'm trained in planning. Jack, who works for me, is here, is planning. We have a whole team. I mean, we have 20 people, many of which are very young, hungry, and eager to do something in the city, and we've created the space for that to happen. So, I mean, I agree with John on some of the context issues and things, but we really focus on what we can change. When I went to planning school, I didn't learn how to correct some of the macro, broader issues that John is focused on. But I think there are things that we can change in the community, and that's really what we're focused on. We've started in one neighborhood, the Idora neighborhood, and we've made great progress there to the point people from many other cities in Michigan, Flint, Detroit, are coming. We've reduced vacancy from 26% to 8% over 4 years there. I mean, we've made massive progress. So obviously we need many more jobs. We need to create income from people, which we haven't done enough of, but there is progress being made, and there's an infrastructure now, I think even a model for the neighborhoods. It's just a matter of scale and resource and creating more economic opportunity for folks.
We do have a slide on the four goals of the plan, and I'm wondering if we could advance to that. If we could kind of focus on what that plan said it was going to accomplish. There we go. And Hunter, I think you were going to say something, and then.
Well, I think this is a colloquium on lessons from Youngstown, and I've had the privilege in the last 3 years of going and working across all of Northeast Ohio, where we have seven legacy cities, the largest being Cleveland, the smallest being Elyria, all of which grew up around from some form of a very very successful industrial base, and all of which, to a greater or lesser degree, have deindustrialized. There's a fundamental rule as a planner when you go before the budget hearings with your city council: cops always win. In a time of budget constraint, basic services, police and fire, always trump the other things. And one of the things I've seen across Northeast Ohio, and I've seen it in Detroit, and I've seen it in many other cities that have gone through this economic tsunami, is that the capacity to reimagine a future disappears. That's true in Flint. One of the big challenges Flint has is it does not have a new planning capacity. One of the things the university provided for many years was sort of a skeleton planning capacity. And I think as we're looking to how these communities can address this, understand that Youngstown at its peak had a planning department was nationally regarded with about 20 people in it. Youngstown today, for a region of this or a city of this size, needs at least five professional planners, if not more, just to keep up with stuff. And so it's. I tell people it's a little bit like having given a guy a heart attack and then wondering why he can't run the Boston Marathon. There is not the capacity, and it's not just Youngstown. It's also in Cleveland, where we used local development corporations extensively, paid for by foundations and also by block grant, to do the work our planning department couldn't do because we couldn't get through that battle with the uniformed services. So this is a reality in all of these places about, so you got a great plan, why can't you carry it out? Well, you're hobbled by the lack of resources that comes from what happened when, this is what happens when cities lose their industrial base. They lose their wealth-creating capacity. And services that people had come to expect get shed, and it's taken a long time for Youngstown to figure out a way around that problem. And then there are all sorts of other issues around the way in which cities are managed with civil service and what happens when a bureaucracy collapses in on itself. But these are realities not just in Youngstown, and if there's any lesson at all, it's that you can do a plan, but you can't carry it out unless you have some ground troops. And we were able to carry out the piece in downtown because the university was committed at least to an area of mutual interest. But we couldn't do the city other than providing backup support with GIS. It took creation of a grassroots effort and foundation funding and the city waking up to the fact that it wasn't going to move forward unless it put the boots on the ground. It's that simple.
So I think, John, you had some specific comments on these four goals, as I remember.
Yeah, I think that the idea of its major goal, I think, was the number two that was successful at. But I'm not sure how much it really improved the quality of life in the city, especially within the neighborhoods themselves. I think Ian's brought up the discussion about the Idor neighborhood, and it's gotten a lot of play, a lot of people come and visit the Idor neighborhood. It's an island in the landscape of disinvestment, blight, and instability. It's impossible to do the things that Ian really wants to do, given the scale that continues to exist. For example, Ian and I were talking, I think, last fall about the city continues to lose 1,200 to 1,400 people a year. That translates into roughly 200 to what, 350 houses that are becoming empty. When you've got 3,000 houses, is that, what is it now, 5,000, 3,000 houses that are empty now? 3,000 houses that are in the area, you can't demolish them all. okay? And you're fighting this as you go along in terms of resources. I've talked a lot about city government, okay? There was so much administrative inefficiency, lack of strategic approach to the demolition issues, lack of code enforcement, where departments were all different and trying to, they couldn't even talk to each other, let alone having the types of equipment that might be helpful to identify where all the problems were developing. And that's why the person's foot that was on the ground that was doing this was Ian and the MVOC people that really looked around and got a look to see how bad the situation was. But Idora is like, has become in many ways like Youngstown. It's an island in this disinvestment and blight and instability. And the city is fighting to stay alive. One of the shocking ones that June and I were talking about before is that one out of every 20 people in Youngstown is a prisoner. Okay? You think about that. It has 67,000 people, and it has over 3,000 prisoners, either in the CCA prison or in the Supermax prison. Now you're going to say, well, who wants to come to a penal colony? And so who is coming to the penal colony are the types of businesses largely that can use them. Racino. Fracking. And that's right now what we're trying to build around. Even though you have this wonderful additive manufacturing system that Obama has given lots of money to, the reality of that type of technology, it's going to cause the loss of as many jobs as it ever creates. It's the nature of the technology itself.
So what is Racino in quick definition?
It's a racetrack with slot machines.
Okay.
And if you look at East Chicago, it's you turn to these types of businesses. And we would have another private prison if the former congressman had his way. But he got indicted and sent to jail.
So let's let Ian have a word in on this. What would you say in response, Ian?
Yeah, I would begin by just saying, obviously, John and I are on opposite ends of the spectrum here. I mean, there are prisons, 1 in 20 people are prisoners, but he's not telling you those people aren't from Youngstown. In one case, there's a private prison that's full of immigrants, but I'm digressing. As far as the islands and the neighborhood issues, I mean, what you have to do in a city like Youngstown and a city like Flint, you have to have a strategy. You have to target resources. There simply aren't enough resources to deal with all the issues. So there are large sections of the city already that are no longer neighborhoods in the traditional sense, and they never will be, at least not as long as any of us are alive. It's the same thing in places like Detroit and Flint. So what we're focused on is stabilizing, revitalizing areas that are transitional, that are functional, that are still somewhat stable, trying to keep a basic quality of life for the people that are in those places, and in some cases create some vibrancy, some attraction to new folks. And you know, while we have certainly a lot to do, we've started to make progress in some of those areas. And many of the things that John is talking about predate the existence of the organization that I work for, and I think we continue to make progress in all of those areas. Again, it's not enough, but I'm very confident that for other cities of our size, given the level of distress, the amount of things that we've changed at a policy level, at a getting things done level, it's fairly high level stuff that we're able to do. I mean, certainly poverty is way too high, all of these things that John can go down a laundry list of, but there is progress being made. And I think the important thing that we're at now, as we were talking earlier, the moment where we are now, as we go through a new planning process, we actually have an infrastructure and we have people behind it that know how to get things done. What's important important in these places, as Hunter can tell you too, is not just being a planner, but how do you take that, how do you move incrementally through it while keeping the long view in mind and getting it done, not just making a plan. And I think we're there now. I mean, we have a lifetime of work in front of us, but the opportunity does exist.
You're striking a lot of themes that we hear with respect to Detroit all the time, foundation support that makes planning possible and continued planning work possible.
And I do want to touch on the foundation support. It was critical in the beginning. The city is a large funder, though. The city was a primary funder of us last year in terms of housing, planning. The city does pay for it. So the city, while they lack capacity, they do understand that there are entities, there are partners they can work with now. Certainly, they could be doing that in many other areas, but we've continued to move through areas where they're not delivering and put together a service that they can work through us to deliver and to be strategic, to do many of the things John touched on. Again, this is a very long process. I'm 31 years old. That Youngstown's been going downhill since I was alive. It's going to take, as I said, really my whole lifetime and my children's lifetime to move back through it. So I do think, though, I'm very excited about the future and what we've put in place.
I wanted to ask one more follow-up, which is accompanying strategic investment is often we're not going to invest in other places. And in Detroit, there's been controversy around enabling people to leave. And I think that was true in Youngstown, too. What happened as a result of suggesting people could leave certain disinvested areas?
So there was really no forced effort. I think it was suggested at many times, and as Hunter, I'm going to quote him here, he says that the Youngstown method is really just being patient and allowing the natural decline in many areas like Oak Hill, where you'd see 70 to 80% vacancy. No one's moving in those areas, so when someone dies, the home is not being reoccupied. Even in the past 5 years, you continue to visibly see those areas hollow out. The city has just put together a project now to covering a small area where they're reassembling about 900 parcels. There's nine vacant houses left, one occupied, so they'll basically take that whole area offline. I mean, it's a very small area given the size of the city, but there's no real concerted effort to forcibly relocate or tell people you have to move from here. There are times when, particularly with, for example, reinvestment in housing, we'll say, unfortunately, we're not able to provide that service to you here, but you can consider relocation. I have a woman coming in my office on Tuesday. She'll be relocating to a new house in an area that's much more functional than putting $80,000 into a house on that's the last left on the street and probably isn't going to survive much longer beyond her.
I think the again, another lesson from Youngstown and from Detroit is that the process of repositioning communities plays itself out in individual neighborhoods and individual households, and it's difficult. We found around the university that the patient approach and the kitchen table approach was the best way to deal with folks. Being there as the buyer of last resort when Mrs. Smith went to the nursing home or went back home to where she had grown up or died. And periodically I'd get calls from people from the area immediately around the campus saying, my mother had passed, would you buy the house? And we would buy the house at the appraised value plus as much as we could as a state university pay above. And that was a good thing for the community, for the family, because they got some value out of it, and it was a respectful end to the family house. We're going to have to think about some ways that are both humane and practical in communities like this, where we have got to reposition neighborhoods for which there is no longer a market. And again, patient acquisition or life tenancies, which was used by the Cuyahoga Valley National Park to buy property of longstanding property owners and allow folks to live on the property until they passed or moved out, but then eventually becomes part of the park. And we're seeing this in that will take a long time, but 20 years from now will be 20 years from now. regardless. It also means not putting tax credit houses, new developments, scatter things around to create an additional investment, but making sure that the folks that are there get the full range of city services, not doing what was done during urban renewal and shutting the place down. When you do what Mary Bing did and say we're shutting down neighborhoods, it gets everybody justifiably very concerned. But the citizens who remain have every right of every other citizen to get the basic services. It doesn't mean that the city should be investing in additional development. And it also does not mean that it should leave to chance the fate of that house when Mrs. Smith dies, goes to the nursing home, or moves in with her daughter down south. That's where a structure of a life tenancy, a structure of a buyer of last resort comes into play. So there's a respectful end, and it doesn't wind up on Craigslist and bought by some flipper from Florida or Cairo or wherever. I mean, we've had all sorts of people buying stuff that was left behind and creating another generation of chaos. So thinking that through is part of what's going on, and I think we're slowly understanding that in Youngstown, on a place that it's the area that Ian is talking about has got hydric soils. In other words, it's a wetland. People are living in a wetland, it's completely undesirable as a place to live. It's a great place for a wetland, and that's where we're looking to see how can we work together to acquire that.
I'm going to give a slightly different skew on this particular. Because you look at what the plan tried to do, it identified transitional, stable, and weak neighborhoods. The plan said for the weak neighborhoods, they wanted to stop providing services. They wanted to neglect the infrastructure repair. It wanted to relocate residents in abandoned parts of the city.
But John, that's not true. We did not put that in the plan.
But that was part of the discourse about the plan.
May have been part of the discourse, but it was not in the official plan that was adopted. Okay. Has not been part of the way in which the city is on.
And what happened was, there was no relocation allowances. There were few residents who wanted to leave their homes. But the neighborhoods that were targeted for this were largely African-American neighborhoods. And the African-Americans called the plan, and not all of them, some of them, denegrofication. Because the parts of the city that were going to be not get the types of investments were in the historically African-American parts of the city. But there was this outcry against this. And a lot of the things that Hunter said is right. They evolved into a different sort of thinking, a more humane way of looking at these neighborhoods and what might be done given the shrinking of resources in cities like Youngstown.
We'd like to be sure to leave time for question and answer, and so I was just going to, according to the plan for the panel, just kind of wrap up by offering some salient points, and then we'll open it up. So we thought, first, I did write down some points about what worked and what were some of the challenges before I came in, and now I have a whole new page of of what worked and what were some of the challenges. But what I came in with, just in terms of what's the reputation of the Youngstown Plan and the Youngstown 2010 effort, first of all, I think it's known for its citizen engagement, that these were people that actually, with a relative amount of drama compared to some other more recent examples, actually did sit down and in a series of meetings apparently come up with some vision of what they wanted to see in terms of Youngstown within the next 5 years. Also, the document itself, if you are interested in this subject and if you haven't looked at it, it is on the web. It's in separate chapters for the PDF, but it's a relatively clear document. For my students, I've given them sometimes several plans to read, and I haven't had to prep them or anything. It's clear, understandable, simple. They're saying what they're going to do, so I think that's really very helpful. This idea of course, looking at decline, I think, was a watershed. So one of the reasons it's famous is that it did accept this vision of a smaller place that essentially was adjusting to depopulation and not constantly fighting it, looking for growth, and that's also important. And of course, the idea that there was going to be implementation in specific neighborhoods. So there is a sector plan within the plan itself. So specific neighborhoods are targeted. And their plan themes. They said they wanted to look at a green network, competitive industrial districts, viable neighborhoods, and vibrant core. I think I knew coming in from some of the things I've read about Youngstown that some of the challenges were the issue of implementation without money. So you can say what you're going to do, but if there are no structures in place or if there's no money, then that's very, very difficult. And so I know in part from reading John's writings that some of the trends have continued to trend downward, but I think even in Ian's documentation, it's clear that there are several variables that have trended in terms of continued population loss and continued challenges of that sort. What I heard from this panel that I think I just want to just briefly point out is that really came through for me. One of the things is just the role of the strong institutional support. I think the fact that there was a Youngstown State University was very good. This idea of looking at the areas around campus or the edges around campus as something that the university would essentially take ownership of, I think, was excellent. The capacity, the creation of capacity, I've come to understand as we've had dialogues in preparation for this panel that there really was, at first I didn't understand that there really was no capacity, but you said it yourself, nobody knew how to do anything. So I've come to understand that there really, it was, yes, there really was very limited capacity. And of course, there was a strategy for stabilization as well. But I think what the challenges that I really appreciate John's thoughts on this as well. Of course, I knew that there would be challenges in terms of neighborhoods in the Central Business District and also in terms of who is the Central Business District for. But I think the main challenge that John's writings have pointed out for me, and I'm sure that everyone would agree with this as well, is that this was a situation of not only severe deindustrialization, but one thing that wasn't mentioned that I know everyone who's involved in the plan and watching the plan is very aware of as well, is that the metropolitan structure that surrounded Youngstown has not changed. So the whole reason for this situation to exist was not simply deindustrialization, but also the population flow outward. And of course, there were racial dynamics to this as well. There was a continued exodus of people that continued even with this plan in place. And so there are larger structural issues that were affecting the plan. So it's not as if you can come in and create a plan, even though it's a visionary, sensible plan, a good plan, that can counter those larger forces without addressing those larger forces. And then who is going to address them? Then you have to talk about the state level or the federal level, and I don't see any action from those people. So I think really there's a lot we can learn from this plan, and there's a lot that we can learn about what a plan can and cannot do as well. So with that, we wanted to give you a chance to ask questions. We actually have microphones. We're going to ask you to address your question within the microphone so that we can hear the audio with the recording.
Thank you for your presentation of Youngstown. Let me tell you up front that I was born and raised in Youngstown, and I also worked in the steel mill back in the late 60s for a brief time before I went to college. And I'm struck by your third bullet there from the plan about improving Youngstown's image and enhancing, in particular, the quality of life. And so as I reflect on Youngstown over the years, I have not seen any improvement in the quality of life, certainly in the neighborhoods. And whether it is a better place to live and work, I think is a highly debatable point. So I think I kind of come down on the side of John here relative to the overall impact. And the significant decline in the population from the late 60s is just astronomical. So I wonder how Youngstown would have fared if Youngstown College had not actually started out just a few blocks from the Central Business District, and therefore it grew out from there, what Youngstown would be today.
I think without Youngstown State University as an employer and as a generator of talent, I mean, you bring in 13, 14,000 new minds into the city every September. That is a regenerative quality that many places don't have. And I compare that with Flint, which has a campus of University of Michigan, but not the same formaticancy, not the same presence physically or in terms of its grounding in community that, that Youngstown State has. So I think it has been a platform for the future. When people ask sort of what is the net out 10 years later of Youngstown 2010, I say we of the four key points that are up there, we got major progress on 3.5 of them. We did accept as a city the reality of being smaller. Now that may not be a big deal, but I will tell you, having worked across a region of the size of the state of Connecticut with seven legacy cities, I can't have this conversation back home in Cleveland, Ohio, because they don't want to talk about the fact they're below 400,000 now. For the same, very same reasons it's happening in Youngstown. So the civic dialogue is a dialogue of a denial in Cleveland. It's a dialogue in Youngstown that is at least trying to figure out what do we do next. And is not looking back to the year when you and I went to the steel mills before going off to college. The good times. Because he doesn't remember the good times. We do. He doesn't. And the reality is there's a different discussion going on in Youngstown because of that. Changing the image and readjusting to the new regional and global economy, Youngstown has done that. There no longer is the discussion only about we used to be in steel. It's a discussion about advanced materials. It's a discussion about manufacturing automobiles at a high quality with the crews. It's a discussion about how do we compete to get a French manufacturing firm to build a steel mill. And it's about additive manufacturing. There's a bunch of different things happening. But again, when I came to Youngstown 10 years ago, it was all about we used to make steel and we don't know what we're doing now. Oh, by the way, we'll do blimps. We'll do prisons. We'll do everything but work in the sector that we actually know something about, which is metals and ceramics. Now, Akron got that message 25 years ago and transitioned from rubber to polymers and redefined itself. Youngstown, which had the same industrial monoculture, did not. So we were able to change that dialogue, that narrative in Youngstown. We have changed the image from being mob city, former steel city, nothing's happening in Youngstown, to something's happening in Youngstown. And I think leveraging the brand for some positive things, you don't get in the State of the Union address twice if it's an embarrassment. There's something happening. That's a change of the image. And we've taken actions. There are all sorts of actions, including the university breaking out of its cocoon, moving towards the downtown, the city reaching up and creating investment and housing in buildings that were standing empty for 30 years, 40 years, where every place else takes a Daniel Burnham historic building and renovates it. Youngstown couldn't figure out how to do that. Didn't want to. Should tear that stuff down. But the quality of life question is the big question. And that's the hardest one. And that's an entrenched reality in a dysfunctional bureaucracy. That's a retrenched reality in the poverty. But the focus is got to be on that. And that's where the work that Ian is doing is finally breaking through. So we got 3.5 of the 4 points, I think, underway or accomplished to a large degree. But the hard thing, which revolves around the quality of life of people in the city, our ability to attract people and investment to the city, the quality of the education that's offered to citizens in the city, those are all issues that need to be addressed because you can't just do this on image alone. But when I got out to Youngstown, it was like I tell people, I do these talks, I said, this is, listening to you all is like listening to Marlon Brando in the back of the taxi and on the waterfront. You know, it's all about what you used to be. What about what you want to be? And part of why you do a vision plan is to ask the question, where do you want to go? Because if you don't know where you want to go, and you don't have the discussions in your community about who are we and what are we all about and why are we still here, then you should either leave or die. Nothing's going to happen. That's where vision comes in.
Ian, did you have...
Sure. I mean, I can add on to that, particularly to your point related to quality of life. We have made improvements. There is capacity now. I will tell you it's an issue of scale. I mean, we're dealing with thousands of properties, many more miles of streets than the city has tax revenue to really maintain. But in areas where we have begun to focus, I can put you on the phone with people right now that will tell you that their quality of life has improved in the last 3 years simply by removing houses, bringing houses back online, cleaning things up. I mean, at a very basic level. I mean, certainly quality of life can be much more than that, but we have made improvements, and I think the improvements will only amplify from here.
I'm just going to give you a reference. Sherry and I wrote an article that started out as a lecture at MIT, and it's called Collateral Damage, Representations and the Uses of Youngstown. And it looks at the reporting on Youngstown over a 25-year period. And Youngstown gets used. And I'm just going to say I heard Obama's speech. Everybody feels very proud that this was mentioned in it. But there's a reason that Youngstown gets mentioned in that speech. There's a reason that Idora gets a certain amount of publicity. For the same reasons a lot of the 2010, it did provide a sense of hope that something was really being done. But in the long run, what we're dealing with is a structural crisis. And a lot of the rhetoric and narratives and discourse about shrinking cities and what's going on there really distracts us from this structural crisis that's going on and that continues. The suburbs are facing the structural crisis now that June, you suggested. It's moving out. When Sherry and I argued in the original book, Youngstown's story is America's story, you know, a couple of regional academics writing this book, but that's become a metaphor for what's happened in America. And that's why I think people keep coming back. Well, what has really happened in Youngstown? Hunter's view, and he was the first to sort of grab onto it, he says, if Youngstown's story is America's story, so is what we're doing. The new narrative has to be what we're doing. And that becomes very powerful because there's a lot of things that Youngstown is doing, the 2010 plan, and there's a lot of things that Ian doing that do say a lot. But at the same time, the question is, how real is it or is this imagined?
Next question.
If I could just do one more comment, add on there. I mean, I fully agree with John. There's structural issues. These aren't structural issues just in Youngstown. This is Gary, Detroit, Flint. I mean, it's the same issues across America. But the reality is we have to do something. And that's what we do every day. We do something about it. Maybe we're not breaking through the structural issues, but we are making some positive, tangible progress.
Another question?
I'd like to go back to 2005. At that time, you started a process of futuring and an action plan. And and usually what happens in most cities, the politicians, the developers, the Chamber of Commerce, and the other moneyed interests, the last thing they want involved in the planning process is the public. But you had a process that involved public participation in decision making, and you came up with that plan and that action plan. I'd like to know how in the world the public was allowed in that process, and I want to know what's happened to that essentially since. What happened to that original plan?
Well, that's a very good point. We did win a national award for the public engagement. I think. I came to Youngstown in 2001. We really got going almost immediately. 2005 when we got it out the door. That was the same period when their congressman was being sent off to jail. That was a period in which my sense as an outsider was the community was saying enough is enough. That was a period in which people said, we got to figure this out. And where the city council had set money aside to do some work to update their plan. We were able to tap into that, starting with some focus groups, the leadership focus groups, getting a similar sense of collinearity around some of these broad themes. We had the event where we announced the vision, because we had a vision and a plan. This is the material out of the vision. The plan is a general land use plan. We were absolutely blown away on a cold December Sunday, a week or 10 days out from Christmas, when 1,500 people showed up at Stambaugh Auditorium. Now, you don't get 1,500 people to show up in the Palace Theater to hear Bob Hope. I mean, that's a huge audience. We were expecting 200, 300, 500. There was something going on in the community at that point where people were saying, we really want to be part of something bigger. And what's going on here? A lot of it was curiosity. A lot of it was the citizens coming out, not only from the city, but from the suburbs. Because, again, from the perspective of an outsider, Youngstown was a national embarrassment, and enough is enough. They tried everything else, from blimp factories to prisons. Everything was a silver bullet. But there was something going on, and it's an inflection point in the community. It was also about a generation after the steel mills had closed. Inherent in that was the notion that the mills are gone, we really have to do something else. Richard Hardwood had come out from his effort and the Hardwood Project, and about a year and a half earlier had identified the fact that people were waiting for leadership. And that evidenced itself. But this really was a groundswell. We did not set out thinking we were going to have 1,500 people showing. I never stood in front of an audience that big. It was mind-boggling. So what happened then? So what happened then is we got a lot of cards, 3x5 cards. We got to took people's names. They want to be involved. We developed a set of working groups around these broad themes and worked very diligently to engage people. We had citizens go out in each one of the neighborhoods and do the first ever building-by-building survey. It wasn't as methodologically correct as we'd like, but it was very intuitive. But we also got on the billboards. We started branding everything. We started talking about it. We had very good coverage from the Vindicator, the local paper. It ran stories about the work. But the other key thing was when we used public television to inform people, local TV, very inexpensively. And the moment of truth there came when Jay Williams, now heading EDA, or now slated head EDA, became mayor, came in as the CD director and said, we got to stop this. It's not working yet. The issues of race and class, which are deeply embedded, particularly in mill towns, were bubbling to the surface again. And there was a large segment of the population that said, this is nonsense. We're not going to go with this. And rather than sort of walk away from it, Jay and the producers, we collectively said, we'll take the next slot on the public television, and we'll talk about the issues of race and class in Youngstown, Ohio, in a live audience. And we'll have a family conversation, because we have to have that. And John, you got involved in helping to frame it. Jay led that discussion. Ground rules about talking polite, talking respectfully with each other. But on television, we started talking about what's underlying a lot of those issues. Producer came to us after that 1 hour segment and said, you're not done yet. We scheduled another one a week later and continued the discussion. Jerry Blaylock came in at the end of that first hour, second hour, and said, you're not done yet. And we recorded a third hour. And that began the process of at least people believing that maybe this one would work. And about 2 months later, we had the unveiling of the plan. There had been some shifts in it in response to all of this, but largely what had to happen is people had to start talking to each other around the dinner table about what's really going on. It's a family intervention in many ways. And 1,300 people showed up to Stambaugh again 3 years later. the essence of the community process had to be civic honesty with one another, because you had to begin to understand that mill towns are big extended families. And we're the old country. This is the old country. These what you did to your father, your grandfather did to my grandfather back in the mills, that matters. I carry that out to the suburbs. And the fact that we don't talk, I don't want to talk to you. Well, you got to. You got to. Because we're not going to even be able to deal with each other as a community until we understand how to deal with each other's people. That's my take on it. That as I watched this. But it was a process that had a lot of different types of involvement. But at the end of the day, it was those TV programs that began to shift the ground. We fully expected another 500 people to show up, and 1,300 people showed up. And it was a much more collegial audience, and a much more, we went through this stuff, let's get to work. And that's when the hard work began. But that was, the key to these to this process has got to be a measure of honesty and a sense that there is a trust relationship that can be forged moving forward. If that, other than that, it's just a plan. It doesn't work.
Another question? Matt.
Question for Mr. Benison, just a very down-to-earth question. I think you guys have alluded to this before, but I mean, a lot of this raises a lot of sort of fascinating larger issues, structural issues and so on, but just at a very down-to-earth level, what do you do, or what would you, ideally, if you could, what do you actually do to all that sort of vacant land that's now, assuming you can tear the buildings down, becoming available? I mean, at the end of the day, leaving all these other issues aside, they're all fascinating issues. I don't want to sort of sound like I'm a practical person and just a boring practical person. Like, all this land is suddenly becoming, at least in theory, sort of available, vacant. Maybe it has no, there's almost no monetary value. Nobody would buy these properties except, you know, flippers or, you know, for very low amounts of money. But do you turn it into parks? Do you sort of, I mean, in one case, I guess you want to turn one area into a wetland because that's sort of what it should be anyway. But other than that, does the land become parks? Does it sort of just get set aside in the hope that 20, 30, 40 years from now, some people will build a warehouse or a factory or you know, new housing eventually? You know, but in the meantime, what do you do with all that empty space? I mean, that's sort of the fact. I mean, that's a question for Detroit. That's sort of a fascinating issue.
It depends on where the land is. I mean, that kind of dictates what you do with it. If you're tearing down one house in a neighborhood that still has some stability, maybe you transfer it to the adjacent homeowner. If you're looking at an area like the Sharon Line that we talked about that has hydric soils and there's no one there, the city's looking at using Clean Ohio Conservation Funds to make it green space in perpetuity. I mean, in some areas, it's just going to kind of go back to nature on its own, and what the future holds for it, I don't think anyone truly knows. And then some places there will be place for economic development, but largely, I mean, in areas that still have some occupancy, trying to just find something productive to do with it, so someone that'll maintain it, whether that's a homeowner that lives next door. And I mean, what you do in each neighborhood is very different based on the level of vacancy, the condition of the neighborhood. I mean, what we've done in the areas where we focus, which are more generally transitional or functional or stable, is work with homeowners. In some cases, you know, we've put a new city park in, but generally you're not putting in a bunch of parks. You're just trying to transfer the land to someone that will maintain it. In one case, we did take about a block offline, 15 houses. We transferred that through tax foreclosure to the Metro Parks because it was immediately adjacent to the park. So again, the context kind of dictates what you do with it, and there's so many different things. But in some cases, where I think maybe where you're referring to large sections of the south side, that'll likely just be vacant land and possibly just convert back to what it was a couple hundred years ago, at least for the time being.
One of the things that we've become much more interested in with dealing with combined sewer outflows, and this is kind of a technical issue, but what we have in many cases are cities that were developed very densely, very quickly during the manufacturing era. The EPA has been pushing to deal with combined sewer outflows in many of our communities, Cleveland, Youngstown, Akron. And the usual solution is gray infrastructure, put big pipes in the ground. Well, we've begun to ask the questions about, can you do green infrastructure? Are some parts of the city best used as part of a strategy for dealing with environmental cleanup in the water quality area, therefore having a long-term maintenance opportunity? One of the big issues that you see in Detroit is you can fallow the land, but then it becomes essentially a nuisance. If you can use some of the land for combined for environmental remediation, and again, it's all very nuanced set of solution. If you can use some of the land to expand metro parks and complete systems that were truncated because the land was too valuable during the industrial era. If you can create new amenities by brownfields remediation and not put industrial purposes back on every piece, but you can also be very selective about the land that has future industrial possibilities. So it's really reimagining and rethinking the landform, because what you find in many of our communities, we built them very quickly, plowed off our streams, water courses, filled everywhere, every which way. Can we back off? Can we relook at it? Can we discover an asset in hydric soils that's a wetlands for natural preservation? I don't know. But it's rethinking, re-understanding the land beneath the city, but also understanding that half the city is underground. That those infrastructure systems are there. There's a great example in Cleveland of a neighborhood that in Central that it was being abandoned for 100 years. That is now a vital neighborhood because the city focused on a home ownership zone adjacent to the community college, adjacent to one of the hospitals, well served by bus lines. It's actually a vital community today. But understanding the assets and the revaluing of the assets left behind, including the asset of open space and the asset of greenscape that can be used to provide green solutions and not, again, cost the taxpayers great money burying concrete in the ground to deal with the water quality issues.
I think we have time for one more question.
Yes.
Where's the mic?
Risk of extending this well beyond your deadline, I'd like to go back to your half a point there, the one you scored yourself 50%. It seems to me when we look at these types of issues, Detroit, Flint, Youngstown, that we're looking at a humanitarian crisis that you're dealing with that has been decades in the making. We're talking about urban blight, we're talking about race and class issues, we're talking about high unemployment, we're talking about low education achievement, we're talking about violence among young men. And realistically, as you look at that goal, over what period of time can we realistically expect to be able to measure some improvement? This has been decades in the making, and it seems to me that it's probably beyond the lifetime of everybody in this room where we will be able to see extremely global measurable progress in these cities because we've let them become humanitarian crises.
Yeah. Well, I think to your point, there's an old saying in business school, it takes as long to untangle a business as it did to tangle it up. These communities started emptying out in the 1950s. 25 years from now is going to be 25 years from now, whether Ian does anything to save it or to change it or not. So there's a measure of focused hope in each of the communities to do the best we can with what we've got and focus on the future. Having said that, what we're contending with is the after effects of an economic tsunami that hit the Great Lakes region of this country, starting in the late 1970s with the collapse of Youngstown's Sheet and Tube. And as I've gone around Northeast Ohio in the last 3 years to do a regional plan, I see the same thing over and over again. And it goes back to Econ 101, Urban Economics 101. When you destroy a community's economic base, you destroy its capacity to function as a community. And by shipping our jobs abroad, and by shipping our jobs to other places in the country, We have destroyed the economic base of places like Youngstown that used to be extraordinarily prosperous. We're going to have to find a new economic base for the communities. But the effects of this tsunami are continuing to be felt. Jim Rhodes, former governor of the state of Ohio, used to say the best welfare for a man is to give him a job. If you don't have jobs, you have all the other dysfunctions we talk about. So this is a very big long-term issue, and to John's point, it is a broad structural issue that needs to be addressed. But 25 years from now is going to be 25 years from now. And what we're trying to say when we talk about Youngstown's story being America's story is we're learning how to deal with this as opposed to denying it. But it needs to be ramped up to a much broader discussion about what the future of places like Youngstown and Cleveland and Detroit are going to be. Because it's very hard to do this without the economics behind it. So exactly to your point, these are the broader issues within which Ian's work has got to operate.
So on that note, I want to say thank you very much for your insights on the Youngstown outcomes. I'm sure we'll be thinking about those for some time to come. Thank you all for your attention and best wishes. No, I'm supposed to tell you, there's a reception outside. I thought I'd forget.